You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of March 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, the United Nations voices concern over a radical EU-Turkey plan to ease the migrant crisis. I'll discuss with my guests Isabel Hilton and Roger Boys the flaws of the new plan, as well as today's other top stories, including Iran announces it has conducted ballistic missile tests to demonstrate its deterrent power, also defying US sanctions imposed earlier this year. And China's ruling Communist Party says it punished as many as 300,000 officials for corruption last year alone. All that, plus former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg's decision not to run for presidency, fearing his candidacy could help the campaign of Mr. Donald Trump. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and Roger Boys, the diplomatic editor of the Times newspaper. Welcome both to the programmes. Let's start with the refugee crisis and a new plan to try to solve it. The United Nations has expressed concern today over a new deal by Turkey and the European Union. Under the plan, all migrants arriving in Greece from Turkey would be returned. For each Syrian sent back, however, a Syrian in Turkey would then be resettled somewhere in the EU. However, the UN warns that any collective expulsion of foreigners is not consistent with European law. Roger, a slightly complicated deal. It's a bit hard to imagine how the mechanics of this work actually when you're on the ocean, you intercept these people. I imagine that people are going to dive overboard and refuse to go back, and they're going to have kids, and it's going to be messy. Do you feel this really is a kind of a policy that's got any hope of working?
Well, everybody wants it to work, and therefore bits of it might work. But the truth is, we're entering some kind of age of deportation at the moment. And this is deportation at really, you know, at a mammoth scale. I think it will not work for different reasons. One is that there's a legal reason. You're rewriting the rules of asylum almost completely in the way you're doing this. The second is the whole question of the one in, one out. I have a similar system with my books at home. I've got so many books at home now that I've decided that one has to go out before I get a new one in. And this is how they're going to operate the system, which seems to me very dubious because, first of all, it gives Turkey a vested interest in allowing people to actually go and actually cheat their way into the EU in various ways, because that's what's going to relieve their own pressure and keep the whole business deal going. So I have a problem with that. I have a problem, I think, with lots of things, but above all with the political ramifications of it, of how far we now have to accept Turkish policies in Syria, Turkish policies everywhere, in a new kind of global partnership, and that therefore that the deal will spread.
Just before I quickly bring in Isabel, is that your concern about that is because Turkey has shown this week, you know, its absolute kind of, you know, it just runs roughshod over kind of press freedom, all sorts of things. It feels very un-EU in the way it does many things. Is that what concerns you about suddenly being forced to, you know, high speed potentially a Turkish application to join the EU?
Yes, I mean, the hypocrisy is right at the very heart of this deal. I mean, it is of most deals, I suppose, but in particular of this deal. You really can't close down an opposition press and then 10 days later get the EU to give you accelerated access to the European Union and European visa regime simply as a part of horse trading. I mean, where does this all end? What kind of moral swamp are we heading into?
Isabel, as we see what happens over the coming weeks, you know, when you see East European countries who've made it really clear that they will not go along with this deal if it does see Turkey fast-tracked, we're seeing Western governments who only like 2 years ago were saying, no way will Turkey ever be a member, not suitable, will never catch up for 10, maybe 20 years with all the demands needed. What's happened that they're just suddenly throwing out all of these requirements, saying we'll give you access to Schengen perhaps even by June, millions and millions of Turks now suddenly allowed to be travelling into the region. It's only going to be a different kind of migration suddenly, potentially then as well, isn't it?
I think this is just the result of failing to solve the real problem. You know, the real problem being the reception and the sorting out of existing migrants. So, in order to plug a hole into the European Union, this absolutely bizarre deal, which I think will last no more than 15 minutes, it seems to me. I mean, 75 million visa-free Turks travelling Europe. I honestly doubt it. And as Roger says, you know, the notion of fast-tracking a Turkish application, which has been kicked around for, to my knowledge, 25, 30 years, it doesn't seem to me to hold up either. And there is a real moral problem. You might argue that some countries that have already joined the EU are no great exemplars of human rights. You know, you could look at Hungary in its current condition. However, that's different from jettisoning the basic principles of the EU, which, you know, rest on democracy, human rights, freedom of the press, and all those things. All of those things have gone backwards in Turkey. And to take Turkey in now would be really, you know, pretty shameful. And it won't, as your question implies, solve the problem. Who decides? You can't return migrants, you can't return asylum seekers under international law. So who decides whether these are irregular migrants or asylum seekers? This bizarre swap of Syrians sent back to Turkey in return for other Syrians moving to European Union. Who chooses? Who decides which ones come? I mean, it's a mess. It's just a further mess on top of an existing mess.
Well, it feels there's also a mess in that you will probably just divert people to come up through Bulgaria or to come up through the Black Sea or to come up through Ukraine. So there's that problem. And there's also the reality that they're saying that many of the people are not Syrians who are going to be returned. They're actually Afghans, Pakistanis, Iranians, Iraqis, Moroccans, all going to be potentially sent back to Turkey, Roger.
Yes, that's correct. And I'm not sure that Turkey actually is in a situation where it can really look after these people. They have camps, but they also have a lot of people living on the local economy, sort of renting apartments and so on. And actually, the treatment that they're getting in Turkey is one of the driving factors for them to cross the water in the first place to Greece. It's not a good existence at all. The other thing is that people smugglers will find other routes, and indeed they already are. So now people are worried about the Albanian-Greece border, for example. There's no reason why people shouldn't come up through Albania and either try to get to Italy or go upwards to Greece. So it's just like water finding a way through a leaky pipe. It will find another way. The core problem is what's happening in Syria, but actually, even if by some miracle we had a peace conference which ended all of Syria's problems and they could all return and set up burger bars, it's the whole gates of misery have been opened. So it's actually most of sub-Saharan Africa on the move at the moment as well.
So, Isabel, we can see this deal is both expensive and complicated and fraught with the possibility of falling over within minutes. But on the other side, there are several problems. We don't want people coming across on boats where they drown and they're being brought over by people smugglers. We don't want to fuel that industry. The reality is, even like Germany, who even the first people it's welcomed, after 5-6 months, many of them are still sitting around, have no employment, have minimum amounts of money, have very little to do, are failing to become integrated. So the process for those European countries in the end, they're not going to cope with these numbers and with it, with all this migration. So what could be done? You know, Roger says even a deal in Syria isn't going to work. You know, do they throw up their arms and say there's nothing we can do? What could be done at this point, do you think?
Well, I think most of them are not actually trying to cope. If you look at the numbers going to which countries, it's a handful of countries that are really have any kind of program to receive migrants. And although the numbers look large in terms of the European population, it's not that huge. So how you persuade reluctant countries to step up, I don't know, including this one, I have to say. But that could be done. I mean,
huge numbers, but in a country like this where we already know that there is inadequate housing for the people who live here, you can't get social housing, it's very hard to get on a property ladder, where there are parts of the country where there is very, there are jobs and there is pressure, especially on low income earners already, although it's not a huge number, it will have some impact. See, I often worry that, when for the likes of us, it has very little impact because they probably don't end up living on your street. They probably end up as your cleaner and your painter and your plumber. But actually, for working class communities, that's who you've got to persuade in the end. People who feel that there is a pressure already coming down on the amount that they're paid per hour and their working conditions.
Yeah, I don't discount your points, but most of those points, which are being blamed on inward migration, actually have other causes as well. You know, the shortage of housing isn't a migrant problem. It's a problem of land use. It's a problem of the structure of the property market. And if you look at the serious research as opposed to the rhetorical statements in our political jabbersphere, at the impact of inward migration, it's pretty much net positive for any economy. 40% of the Fortune 500 companies in the United States were founded either by migrants or children of migrants. You know, these are, on the whole, people who, if not in the first generation, then in the second generation, make an enormous contribution. And I have seen, waves of panic over migration come and go in this country. You may remember the Kenyan Asians or the threat, in quotes, of Hong Kong inward migration. These populations were pretty positive for the UK economy, and I think we can do a lot if we stop blaming migrants for the ills of our system, which are systemic and won't be solved by keeping migrants out.
I kind of agree with much of what you're saying, but Roger, when you look at this, at the question of migration, there does seem to be like the two versions of migration. We talk about the migration there that happened after Idi Amin came in Uganda, for example. Most of the people who left were business people. They spoke English. They'd had, they were from Asian communities that had always invested in education. Many of the people we're seeing, not from Syria, but many of the Afghan people arriving, they are said to be, young men travelling on their own, often illiterate, without a trade or a transferable trade. So for them, it is not going to be a movement into, you're not going to be a net gain for the economy for some years, are you?
No, I think that's correct. Although I too am broadly in agreement with Isabel about this. I do think there's a problem of concentration. That's to say, them all being people being farmed out in great numbers to certain areas, so that infrastructure is overstrained, and the second is, as you say, that they are actually swelling an underclass that will be exploited and will create some kind of and will pull wages, average wages down. And will create some sort of social tension at the bottom. But these are risks. These are risks that we have to take. And on the whole, immigration does expand an economy and create opportunities. A lot of these Asians, Ugandan Asians, were not actually highly literate at all, but they were entrepreneurial. They set up their newspaper shops and their corner shops. They understood there was a niche in the British economy to make money, and they did it. And I see no reason why Afghans, in fact, my local news agent is an Afghan, so there's no reason why on earth they shouldn't see these little gaps in the economy and prosper as well.
I think we're going to probably have to move on, because there's so many more things I want to ask both of you, but we need to move on.
I'm sure the topic will come back.
I have a feeling. It's a fascinating, moving story. how we cope and what countries are going to do and where people will move to. But we're going to continue now with an announcement by Iran that its armed forces have conducted new ballistic missile tests to demonstrate the country's all-out readiness to confront threats against its territorial integrity. With the tests, Iran defies US sanctions that were imposed earlier this year aimed at disrupting the country's missile program. US officials say that if reports of missile tests are confirmed, they would raise the matter at the UN Security Council. Isabel, you know, the deal, the election, we're feeling kind of a bit warm and cozy about Iran, but we need to remember that it's still a country with, you know, strong military aims and ambitions in the region. We're talking about Syria. It's heavily involved in Syria. It's not going to go quiet on this front either, is it?
No, and we're looking at a country where there are, to put it no more strongly, different strands of opinion on this deal. And the ballistic program, which is under the control of the Revolutionary Guard, is one of the hardline and most militant sections of Iranian society, which makes it tricky, really, in terms of response. Because do you punish all of Iran for this, thus potentially weakening the liberal elements in the Iranian polity, which you want to encourage? Do you not seek to impose sanctions? Would that require Security Council approval? In which case, what would China do? China is Iran's biggest customer for oil. China watered down previous UN resolutions in order to give lots of get-outs. I suspect that what will happen in this instance is that there will be a lot of harumphing and a lot of disapproval, but very little real response.
Roger, is that your feelings? Well, because in the end, the machinations going on just around Syria, everybody wants to kind of get on in the end because they're hopeful, as you say, that there will be a deal there that will impact on all sorts of things, including the migrant crisis.
Yes. I've always been sceptical about this Iranian deal, to be honest. Even if we accept that the nuclear deal is not going to be cheated on, it doesn't exclude the possibility that Iran will seek to assert itself regionally with conventional weapons. And that is one of the things it wants to say at the moment. It wants to tell us that it's not defenseless just because it's withdrawing from the nuclear program. The context could be defensive. That's to say, it's worried that Israel is going to hit Hezbollah in Lebanon at some stage quite soon, and it looks like something like that might happen in the next week or so. So Iran is worried about that and wants to show, and it's a message to Israel, of course, these missiles that they're testing all have, or most of them have, Israel within their range. But I don't want to be too understanding of a society or of a government that is actually pretty crooked. And I think there's a long bad history of people saying that getting weapons and testing weapons for defensive reasons and then using them aggressively. So I think there's something very destabilizing happening in Iran at the moment, and we've really got to watch it, and that we've been a little bit too blue-eyed about this whole nuclear deal.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Isabel Hilton and Roger Boys. Coming up next, China's ruling Communist Party says it's punished hundreds of thousands of officials for corruption last year. And also the former New York mayor, Michael Bloomberg, says he will not be standing against Mr. Trump.
The roadhouses along the Great Northern Highway in Western Australia are vital, serviceable sanctuaries for the truck drivers who frequent them. Monocle correspondent Liam Aldiss and photographer Graham Miller hit the road to meet the colourful characters who rely on these outback pit stops.
In the town of Kew, we saw firsthand how the historical peaks and troughs of Western Australia's mining boom have shaped the man-made landscape. It was here we met the self-designated Queen of the Murchison, Carla Nilsson. She shared plenty of terrific and maybe tall tales involving modern-day helicopter-riding prospectors, film crews, and even a delegation from the Perth Paranormal Society who had dropped by to inspect the allegedly haunted old Freemasons' Lodge around the corner.
Stop and Start, a photographic essay now playing in the Films menu on Monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Roger Boys and Isabel Hilton. Now, China's ruling Communist Party has announced it's punished nearly 300,000 officials last year for corruption. Some 200,000 officials were given what's called light punishment, while more severe penalties were taken against a further 80,000. President Xi Jinping has made a campaign against corruption a centrepiece of his governing agenda. The number of those caught in 2015 was released during China's annual parliamentary session. Isabel, we have to start with you on this. The numbers are off the chart. What does it mean, 300,000 people? How have they caught 300,000 people with their hands in the till?
Well, because, you know, many, many more than that have their hands in the till. It's absolutely systemic. Of course, China's numbers are big. It's 1.4 billion people and what, about 70 million Communist Party members, against which 300,000 as a proportion ain't that big if you take the reasonable assumption that pretty much all local officials are on the take in some way or another, and that the corruption goes, you know, gets bigger as you move up the scale. It's a very popular campaign because the, you know, rather downtrodden Chinese people are very fed up of corruption in the Communist Party. But it is... It's not tokenistic, but it's not systemic either. So the kind of changes to the regime which would deal with corruption, which would be a proper functioning legal system, more media freedoms, you know, the ability of citizens to finger corrupt officials, all of those spaces are being closed down. Xi Jinping has ruled out rule of law, preferring rule by law. In other words, the party uses the law as it chooses. Media freedoms have been closed down in the last 2-3 years. And citizens, there was at the beginning of this campaign, some citizens were brave enough to suggest that it would be a good idea for Communist Party officials to have to disclose their assets. And their feet barely touched the ground before they themselves were behind bars. So looking at who's targeted and what the effects might be is pretty interesting. None of what you might call Xi Jinping's circle have been targeted. He's hit the oil industry, which he has to bring to heel. He's taken quite a few people out of the armed forces, again, in preparation for a reorganization of the armed forces, which might be resisted. And notoriously, he took down a standing committee member, former standing committee member of the Politburo, Zhou Yongkang, who was the man in charge of the security services, not a man you'd want to have outside the tent. And he'd been a supporter of Xi Jinping's great rival for the job, Bo Xilai. So, you know, you can certainly make the case that this is a very useful campaign for getting rid of your enemies, but it's not really going to cure corruption inside the system.
Roger, it's interesting when you look at the BRIC nations that, you know, we were so excited about. You know, now Brazil caught up in this huge Petrobras scandal, unpicking the country. We've seen the former president Lula arrested last Friday. We see 300,000 people in China. It may not, as Isabel is saying, be really getting to the root of the problem, but that's still a large number of people. We know that Russia is riven with corruption at every level, and India isn't much better. When you look at these emerging countries, these powerful bloc of countries, all their economies seem to be shot by the fact, partly, that corruption is kind of pulling them down. Do you think that in the end that these governments have begun to realise that, you know, you can't just carry on with, you know, the odd thank you gift here, the watch to say thank you for your help in this project, that something needs to be done at a more deep-rooted level about corruption?
Well, I think Brazil is a slightly different case because actually there something quite laudable is going on there. That's to say that the institutions are working to weed out, in particular, the Petrobras scandal, but the whole overlap between business and politics is being looked at very precisely. I mean, it's really a big deal to... it's not like putting Bo Xilai on trial in China. This is something quite comprehensive and quite interesting, what's going on in Brazil. But yes, I think... but countries like Russia and China, you know, they are closed societies, and the investigation of corruption is an instrument of political change. It's not something that's being done for to raise the moral fiber of the nation. It's to get rid of cadres that you don't like. It's also to point a finger at security or the people who are supposed to be controlling corruption and identifying them as not being effective. I would like to think, but I bet Isabel doesn't think this, that it's part of some broader moral renewal that's going on, or someone identifying the limits of behavior in a fast growing economy. But I don't think so. Last year I was in Macau in one of these ghastly casinos, Venetian, copied from Las Vegas. And there's this massive hall. In fact, there's several massive halls, but there's one where you can house 2,000 gamblers. And they were all mainlanders, wearing shell suits, chain smoking, spitting on the floor. And each chip that they had was a grand, was $1,000. $1,000, not $1,000 Hong Kong dollars, $1,000. And they were. I don't know whether they'd come over from the mainland by bus. And what were they doing? Where did that money come from? What kind of subterranean economy is flourishing and allowing these people to gamble and worry about lucky numbers rather than having a policeman on their shoulder?
What Rob Rogers is describing is doesn't feel like the world has changed. But when you speak to people in China, when you go there, do you think that there is, you know, with this culture of giving watches, of, you know, fancy gifts, and these extravagant restaurant meals and things? We saw this clamping down on that. Do you think that's actually bitten, that kind of world has changed a little bit?
Yes, it has. And people are reluctant to entertain publicly, and certainly the gift giving has calmed down. But, you know, I've just watched a Chinese documentary, which I highly recommend to you, called The Road, which is about the building of a stretch of road in Hunan province as a result of the economic stimulus in 2009. At every step, in every transaction of that, you know, stretch of concrete, there were officials with their hands out, waiting for the red envelopes, you know, chipping away. At one point, the traffic police, who don't get a sufficient bribe, physically send thugs to beat up the workers. I mean, this is a gangster state, and it goes right down through every single transaction. So the surface stuff, yes, the gift giving and the extravagant entertaining, that certainly has, you know, people have drawn in their horns. But the systemic stuff, I really don't think has changed.
Now, we only have about a minute and a half left, but we have one more story to squeeze in, and that's Mike Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York, has said he will not be standing as an independent, for he fears that his presence would split the vote and help Mr. Trump. Isabel, we'll start quickly with you. A wise decision? Is he being completely honest? I wonder whether he just thinks, what a miserable race to get into, and how bruising and damaging for his future.
Well, he might think that, but he's certainly prepared for it. I mean, he has, you know, built up a war chest. He had the ads done. He had the slots booked. And I think it probably is a wise decision. That he would have campaigned as an independent, and the fate of the independents in US presidential elections is largely to drain votes from those closest to them, in which, in this case, I think that's Hillary Clinton. So he would probably have enabled a Trump victory. At least there was a high risk that he would have enabled a Trump victory, the last thing he wanted.
Roger, just almost a minute left. But I understand he'd been on The Apprentice twice as well, which I'm sure he got bashed by Mr. Trump for being changing his tune once or twice as well.
But, well, I mean, I welcome any belated recognition by businessmen that they're not fit to be politicians, really. On the whole, they make a mess of it. And if he's worried that he'll end up like Ross Perot or something, well, then good for him. You know, stay out of it. And Trump is really an object lesson for all of them.
And just finally on that, I know that you say he's an object lesson for all of them, but did not Mike Bloomberg at least have some kind of cleanliness around him? He was, you know, even though he was from wealth, he was a bit like Trump. He could have been self-funded. He didn't need to kind of depend on the kind of the donors and the PACs and everything.
Maybe these donors are not such a bad thing, I'm beginning to think. at least there's some kind of restraint and accountability to these people. Trump has so scared me that I think, you know, bring me back those polls, you know, the old polls.
Well, that's another story I think that we may have to come back to once or twice over the coming weeks. But I'm afraid we're going to have to leave the show there today. Isabel Hilton and Roger Boys, thank you so much for joining me on Midori House. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie. It was researched by Fernando Alcocer-Pacheco and Charlie Moynihan. And our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Carlotta Ribello continues today's Atlantic Shift next. Then at 1900 hours, it's Section D with Josh Fennett. And we'll have more of the day's news stories on the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours with Emma Nelson. The Drury House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time. I'm Andrew Tuck. Just want to say thank you very much for listening and goodbye.